All cars ain't exciting, but that'll make them any less valuable to your journey or mine. Why don't you step inside today while I talk about one of the most boring cars I've ever known?
I have the thousands of songs I could use for this car. I think I have to use some oldies. My mom always liked the oldies station back when it was 94.5 in Houston. Maybe that Righteous Brothers song, the one that used to go like, Lonely rivers flow to the sea, to the sea. Yeah, just imagine that one. I'll see you inside.
Welcome to the Wrecking Yard. I'm Jerry Wayne Longmire. If you haven't seen or heard the first episode, I always recommend you go back and check that out. You ain't got to, but it helps. If you're a returning viewer, let me just thank you for sharing some more of your time with me, you know. This episode is brought to you by nobody because I ain't got a sponsor yet. But when I do, it'll probably go right here and it'll be something along the lines of so-and-so makes the finest thing in my jig available. And boy, life's never been so good as since I started using so-and-so's Diamond Gem certified thingamajig or thingamajig spray or what have you. And then that'll be the sponsor. And then we'll just move on into the show. Today we're going to discuss the magic and the mystery behind GM A-body cars, the front-wheel drive ones. And before we jump off in that, we're going to read a few comments from last week's episode. All right, comments. Let's go. I didn't print them out this week because I was trying to save printer ink. And if you're anything like me, you've had some epic fights with printers. All right, here we go. Wow, who's this? At L1A146. Wow, run over by a 69 Galaxy. I swear I had a 70 Galaxy back over me, but Dad said that was an accident. So much cooler than getting run over by a Camry, though. Man, I guess. I'm trying to think. I've been run over by a 69 Ford Galaxy, a 1994 Chevrolet pickup, and I had a 91 Dodge Dakota dropped on me, and I don't really recall any of them being any cooler than the others. That Galaxy, she ran over me with a car. Boy, I used to I had many people over the years, you know, when I would talk about that situation back then, they'd go, oh, it's such a wild story y'all have. Do you remember when you fell for her? And I was like, no, but I remember when I fell out of love with her. And it was right about the time I was bouncing off the hood of that 69 Ford Galaxy. She was, that was a time right there. Let's see, on to the next one. That Chris Troxler. Oh, I know Chris. Boy, I cussed out loud when you mentioned cash for clunkers. That's one of the reasons why I have a yard full of cars, parentheses, 70s now. Yeah, I don't blame you. 70s is probably my favorite decade of cars anyways. But cash for clunkers turned out to be one of the most insidious programs ever created. And that's, I mean, I ain't going to get all political because I don't really like to talk about my political beefs with other people, and I don't really want to hear theirs, to be honest with you. But it just doesn't seem like there's a lot of things that get put in the hands of government and bureaucracy that turn out to be good things. I can't think of too many examples. I'm sure there's some out there I'm not thinking of, but that program just, it ruined a bunch of cheap, reliable, good cars that people could be driving and buying right now. Let's see, what else do we have? Oh, God, I remember this, reading this. Preston VB. There's a crazier urban legend in either the Navy or Marine Corps about one who used a raccoon as bellows to bypass a breathalyzer interlock system. It all went well until the raccoon regained consciousness while the sailor/marine was driving and attacked him, causing a crash. There is a screenshot of the base blotter out there on the internet. I don't even need to see the screenshot of this base blotter to know that was a Marine. I have spent an inordinate amount of my career entertaining the military and soldiers and veterans, and I assure you that has to be a Marine story. It just has to. It just has to. I have so many. There's a sentence here where it says it all went well until the Ragoon regained consciousness. If well is the standard of I used a tranked out raccoon to pass my breathalyzer to start my car and get to work, we have very different bases, you know, of what's good and what's not. Jesus. Oh, shit. I have so many questions about that story. One, I know he didn't start with a raccoon, right? How many things did he try on that little... I used to have a neighbor live across the street from me. The guy was such a jerk. But he had one of those things on his car. And it was sort of satisfying every morning to watch him have to go out there and blow his car to see if his car was going to get him to work that day. And it was even more satisfying when he'd have to go stand at the end of the street and wait for a cab to come pick him up. How many things did this old boy try on that breathalyzer, get that breathalyzer unlocked? You know, did he try like a fireplace bellows? Like a... I assume it needs some kind of CO2 content or something for it to work. So did he try to get the dog to do it? The dog wasn't into it, you know, like the dog wouldn't breathe hard enough to pass the breathalyzer. Did he just already have a raccoon problem? Because I've had a raccoon problem where I had to trap raccoons all the time, but it just never dawned on me to use them for other purposes. I usually just relocated them. But it makes me think he already had a raccoon problem. And how many raccoons did it take? How many raccoons before he figured out, you know, the science or the chemistry behind what he was giving it to drug it to leave it unconscious? How hard do you got to squeeze a raccoon to pass a breathalyzer? You know, like, did you break ribs? You know, like, this doesn't sound like a great story for the raccoon. I bet he did attack you. I bet he did. Those things are related to bears. You don't mess with raccoons, man. I hope that story ends with him getting a DWI from getting in a wreck with a raccoon. And I just want to hear the raccoon side of the story. You know, is it like Stockholm said? How many times, if he was so confident to do it once, how many times did he get away with it? How many times did this guy sit at work with a tranked out raccoon sitting in his car? I have a lot of questions about that story, but by God, that's hilarious. Well, let's jump off into it. Ooh, that coffee's good. It's what you need sometimes. Got me a little something here to fuss with. Don't need that phone anymore. I'll put that over yonder. In the summer of 1989, we moved to Houston, Texas, when the oil field tanked. I don't know. Man, do y'all remember the big oil crash in the late 80s? And there's big banners on the buildings in downtown Houston. Come back, we won't waste it. And we always do every time. When the oil field tanked, it just about ended a little town of Kilgore. Jobs were scarce, and I mean everything. A little valve company my dad worked for named WKM. Basically, that plant, the company got bought by Cooper Industries, and that plant got shut down. And my dad had worked his butt off there. He had, like, come up from the R&D department and the draftsman and was working in quality control. I don't know if he was a quality control manager yet, but he was pretty close. He was, like, one of the lead men in the quality control department. When they sold that company off, when they sold it off to Cooper Industries, they offered my dad a transfer to Houston, which is fine, but we were going to have to relocate our whole family and everything. And, you know, my mom didn't want to go. I sure didn't want to go. You know, I was a kid. I think I was 9 or 10. I didn't want to leave behind my family. When we lived in Kilgore, we were Pentecostal, and we were attached to our church family and attached to our big family. I had already lived there. So It was scary going to Houston. You're going alone, you know, to a really big city, and people in the out back then in the country, they were terrified of big city, you know. It's not like we had the option to stay. Maybe there was an option to stay there. I don't know all the details behind it back then. But I can tell you this. It's the same story what happens a lot of times in small towns when those companies get bought stuff and they offer a couple people a job. Everybody else turns on those people. And they were pretty nasty to my dad, you know. And I get it. When folks are scared, they've lost their job, their thing, it's not always your finest moment, you know. But they would even to the point of making like comments in church, making snide comments to him in church about missing church on Sunday night because he had to drive back to Houston to be ready for work. All I know is the old man had a pretty decent gig and they offered him a better one. And he didn't have a college, he hadn't finished college, and he had worked his tail off to get where he was, you know, and I can understand not wanting to give that up, and I can certainly understand thinking it's the best way to provide your family. Just to kind of give you an idea of how hard the old man worked, he did have a college degree. He's been a vice president at two major corporate, one of them being GE, without a college degree. He's been a chairman of the American Society for Quality Control boards over the years. He's done stuff with API. All without ever getting this little piece of paper for some four-year school. He did all that just from sheer hard work and determination. One of the first places we lived when we came to Houston was a little crappy apartment complex called Belero at the corner of Bel Air and I think Attics Clothing. Little dingy place. I think they called them the Belero Apartments, and then for a while they were called the Hawthorne. I don't even know if they're still there. They were pretty run down when I lived in them as a kid. I was a very shy kid at that point, and believe it or not, I was also very small for my age. I was kind of a runt. I was one of the littlest kids in my class, and I talked like this. I'm trying to tell you, it was a bad time to be me. I was bullied mercilessly the first 3 or 4 years of living in Houston. They'd make fun of, you know, my family didn't have any money. They'd make fun of our Kmart clothes and make fun of the way I talked and my Payless Pro Wing shoes. Kids are mean, man. I've met my first friend in that apartment complex. Her name was Melissa, but her whole family called her Missy. But she's just another kind of little shy girl with glasses that lived in the apartment complex. But she was my very first friend in Houston. She helped me kind of find my place and things, and you know, having a friend changes everything for you, having somebody you can hang out with. Later on as adults, we were unkind to each other, but that is a story for another car. I think we only lived in that place about a year or so. Before we were able to, the old man had worked really hard. We were able to rent a house in Mission Bend, and my parents were able to buy a used 1986 Oldsmobile Cutlass Sierra from Enterprise Rental Car. And that was the newest car we'd ever had at that time point in our family. It was a big deal. My dad took us all to Cliff's Hamburgers that night. We didn't go out. Back then, people just didn't go out to eat every day. It wasn't like a thing, you know. It was kind of a rare treat. Y'all remember Cliff's? Does anybody remember Cliff's? I think it was off like A-Leaf Clodine and Highway 6. Boy, damn, that was a good hamburger. I always liked that place. Oh, that leather's stiff. The front-wheel drive A-bodies the Celebrity, the Pontiac 6000, the Cutlass Sierra, and the Buick Century are largely credited with saving GM in the 80s. And also, they're one of GM's biggest embarrassments. Fortune magazine put the whole lineup, right? The Pontiac, the Buick, everything on the cover of one of their 1983 magazines to demonstrate how bland and generic GM's styling had become. And the only reason that you could even tell those cars apart from one another after 1985 is because GM got memed hard before that was even a thing. Regardless of that, the front-wheel drive A-body is one of the most successful platforms in American automotive history as far as sales. It continued to sell well up into the 90s, and even after GM decided to discontinue the lineup, they still had to keep making cars to fulfill the need. So the car was produced well up on, I think, in 95 or 96. Well after they had decided to get rid of the car. Weirdly enough, Americans seem to like cheap cars that are durable and can run forever and be repaired by your average driveway wrench slinger. You hear that, GM? Do I need to say it louder for y'all in the back? Maybe just try to build it. Y'all are in trouble right now. You're not doing too good. Maybe now's the time. Just build us a nice little durable shit box that we can pick up for about 10 grand. That would be fantastic. I have a theory that more people in the United States have a story about one of these cars than any other kind of car. The car line was so successful and so popular, and there was just so many people learned to drive in them. I just think you can probably hear more stories about this car than any other car. You can bring up a front-wheel drive GM car of this era in an airport in Turkey with a Norwegian that you mistook for an Alabaman and have a two-hour conversation in broken English with a stranger. I know. I've done it. In my defense, I was stuck in a foreign land, and every time I thought I saw somebody in the airport, I was in this Turkish airport for about 8 hours. Every time I saw somebody in this airport, I thought it might be just like a displaced good old boy like me, and I would go up and introduce myself. They would turn out to be Norwegian, which is kind of a weird thing, you know? Like, they were always super excited to talk to a Texan, you know? Texas is apparently as mystical a place to them as Norway is to me. Texas is kind of weird like that, you know. And cue the Texas. I know there's so many people who are mad at Texas for whatever reason. I joke around with other states. Oh, we got a moth. Come on, buddy. I joke around about other states and stuff, but I really have no animosity toward them. But Texas is weird that I think it's mainly because of the far reaches of the oil industry. I met a group of seven-year-olds when I was doing some military tours one time. I went to Kuwait and Iraq, and I met a group of seven-year-olds outside of Baghdad that were playing soccer, and they didn't speak a lick of English, and they were asking, the translator was asking us where all we were from, and they didn't register anything about anything. I was there with two other comics, and one of them was from Buffalo, and one of them was from Indianapolis, but when I told them I was from Texas, these kids got excited, bro. And this one of them took a stick and drew a better Texas than I can in the sand. And then those kids all wanted autographs from me because I was from Texas. And my best buddy, Chris Shaw, who was on the tour with me, proceeded to give me crap about it the rest of the tour. We'd be laying there in our bunks at night, wherever our living quarters were for that night, and it would be real dark, and you'd hear Chris real soft go, "Hey, Jerry Wayne, can I have a Texas autograph?" I love Chris Shaw. If y'all don't know who he is, he's one of the funniest comedians working the circuit today. Big old boy from Indianapolis. He's really funny, and one of my best friends, man. Love the guy. So you should definitely check out some of his stuff if you get the opportunity. Our car had the GM, the Iron Duke, right? Which is, the engine's legendary all on its own. you know. It was so durable, in fact, that with minimal maintenance, you could get several hundred thousand miles out of those engines. And GM sold it to AMC, and to use in some of their vehicles. They also, they put them in those damn Eagle things, those four-wheel drive things. They also sold them to Grumman. So chances are, at some point, you have had mail delivered by a Iron Duke four banger. My dad felt like his father hadn't taught him much about mechanics, and he had learned a lot from his father-in-law, my papa Clark, and he took it on himself, I think, to make sure I wasn't going to be in the same boat. He devoted a lot of time to teaching me a lot of different things, I will say that. I was his mechanics helper from about the age of 9 to 17, and I bet I learned more about working on cars from that Oldsmobile than any other car. I feel good about saying that. I haven't talked much about my mom yet because it's kind of a difficult situation. And it's a little difficult for me. But there's one thing you need to know about Sherry Kay, especially for this story. Sherry Kay loved her music loud, and she never met an engine she couldn't kill. Ford 300? Nah. Iron Duke? They couldn't hang with her. She just, like, I'm not one of those people who gets all hung up on, you gotta warm up a car for such and such long. I don't feel that way. But my mama would start the car, and by the fifth revolution of the engine, she was in the street with her foot on the right pedal going somewhere. You know what I mean? And if car started overheating, she didn't care if she was going home. I told y'all about that Charger, right? She drove that thing all the way home with missing a tire. You know, she didn't let nothing slow her down when it come time for her to go home. And this little car was mainly her car for a long time. And whoo, boy, did she put it through its paces. I don't know how many head gaskets and those dog bone engine mounts that she went through on that car, but literally my dad would whip in the driveway. She would call him at work, tell him the car was smoking again or overheating, and he would whip in the driveway. He would already have the gasket in hand. He done stopped at the high-low on the way home. And I remember me and him would have that head pulled off that block when the block was still hot enough you could fry an egg off of it. That's how good we got at tearing that little four-cylinder down. Not that it's a particularly difficult one to do, but we had a damn bubble. I spent countless nights in the driveway with the old man, you know, just under a drop light helping him, because she would, the car would be jacked up, he'd have to fix it so she could do the stuff she needed to do the next day, and also he could go to work the next morning. To this day, I can't smell Dawn dishwashing soap without thinking about him when we'd get done working on those cars at night with his shirt off, washing his arms in the sink, and tell me to get all the grease and the oil from under my fingernails because I had to go to school the next morning. He had a thing about cleanliness and order. I've worked outside most of my life at this point, even though I don't do it as much anymore. And my wife will tell you, even when I was working the dirtiest jobs, I still had a thing about my fingernails. I don't like my fingernails being dirty. It bugs me today. You won't ever, it's to this day, I'll clean them out with a pocket knife before I go anywhere. He told me one time that it was something along the lines of not having money was no excuse for being dirty. And if we had to stop, go get a part while we were working on something, he'd go take a shower and put on clean clothes for the drive to the high-low. You know, he wasn't going to go in there with dirty clothes on and sweaty and greasy. Now, I haven't been that bad Trust me, if I'm working on a car, I need to go get a part, brother. I'm showing up looking how I look. He taught me how to change McPherson struts on that car. That was my first experience with that, and I'm still terrified of them. Especially after some years later, I was trying to do one myself and rocketed a coil and a pair of welding pliers off into the fender of a Ford Taurus, and nearly cost myself a mouthful of teeth doing it. Those things still frighten me. I've done a couple of them since then, but whoo, they still make me, my little butthole just puckers right up, you know, like I'm about to start making upholstery. All right, one time she fried the, my mom fried it so bad, one time she cracked a piston, and we had to change a piston while the block was still sitting in the frame, but me and old man did it, pulled that old pan, got under there, you know, he just did it, he just did whatever had to be done, you know, that was just, he just wasn't one of those, there was never a guy to call, you know. If the hot water heater went out, the old man threw me in the car on Saturday morning. We went down to Montgomery Ward's and bought a hot water heater. There was no plumber. There was no HVAC guy. There was just Dad. I had driven trucks and go-karts and all manner of moving things in the junkyard as a way of, like, learning how to operate machinery. But when it came time to learn how to drive on the street, I learned how in this car. In this 86 Oldsville Cutlass Sierra, my dad took me down to the Albright Middle School parking lot and taught me how to street drive, basically, you know, before I went and got my learner's permit and took defensive drive and all that good stuff. Or driver's ed. They got their money's worth out of that car, okay? I think it had 200,000 miles on it when my dad sold it, and he actually sold it to Melissa's stepdad. And it became her first car, too. And then her stepdad, like, fixed it up and went through it and fixed all the little interior jiggles and here and there. And then he sold it. There ain't no telling where that car might still be running the road somewhere. It might have got traded in on the Cash for Clunkers program. Who knows? I know this. It made countless trips back and forth between Kilgore and Houston. So much I still think I live kind of right off 59 now. And anytime I come into 59 South, pulling into Houston, and I see that skyline of downtown, it still reminds me of that car. I went on my first date in that car with Melissa. And my dad was driving. I was in middle school, actually. Melissa wanted to go to this place called Fame City. I think it was on Bissonnette or Beechnut. I think it's called Funplex now, if it even still exists. But it's called Fame City, and she wanted to go up there for the Halloween festival. So my dad drove me over to her house, and I went and knocked on the door. My parents were still kind of Pentecostal. Like, we may have lived in the big city, but we were still living some kind of way. And so he drove me over to their house to knock on the door and shake her dad's hand and ask him if I could take her out for the evening. And then my dad drove me back over there to pick her up and drove us to the Halloween festival at Fame City. Fame City, for me, was like that scene in Karate Kid when him and Allie go out to the big Funplex place or whatever. I was still pretty shy and nervous at this time. And she always made me feel less like that. That was something she was good at. But I forgot to tell her I was scared of ghosts and shit like that. I was scared of haunts and haunts. And I still, to this day, I don't watch horror movies. I don't enjoy horror movies. I don't enjoy being scared. I've been scared enough in my life. I don't have any interest in recreating that. But I let her, as sometimes boys will let young girls do, convince me into going into the haunted house with her. Which turned out to be disastrous because the dude jumped out with a chainsaw with no blade on it. And I ran into her and knocked her into a wall. And she had a big old black eye, like swollen face. Date over. Yeah, that was pretty embarrassing because then everybody at school wanted to know what happened to her. And then I guess she told some people without giving a whole lot of explanation because... My buddy come and punched me in the face about it because he thought I hit this girl, which was in no way the case of what had happened. But yeah, he come punch me. We're still friends today, believe it or not. It was my buddy Randy Lee. He's the guy that did my my Blue Jay tattoo after my mom passed. He knew my mom well. He knew our family well. He was a part of my life for a long time when I was young. About this age period, we were living all around Mission Bend. We lived probably like three different locations in Mission Bend from the time I was about 9 or 10 to the time that I was in high school. We also went on our first and our only multi-state family road trip in that car. Mom and Dad and me and my sister, and we went to the Painted Desert and Carlsbad Caverns and all the way to the Grand Canyon one summer in that car. I've never done this with my kids, and I'm pretty sure it's because of this trip. I feel like the old man was pissed off the entire trip, except for when he was like staring out at the Grand Canyon, you know. And even then, I'm not 100% sure that he wasn't staring out there thinking about throwing one of us in. I mean, it wasn't no iPads. And y'all remember, wasn't no iPads. Wasn't nothing to entertain yourself with in the back car. If you're lucky, you might have a Discman or a Walkman or something. But it was pretty much an 8-year-old and a 13-year-old pestering each other relentlessly for like 2,000 miles. It's a miracle the old man survived it. It's a miracle we both survived the trip. I bet there's a ratio of butt whoopings and hey boy to fuel mileage I'm not good enough at math to figure out. I have spent a lot of my life just enraptured with New Mexico, though, and I can't help but wonder if that's where it all started for me. I've had a lot of great times in New Mexico. My Uncle Bobby at the time, I talk about him a lot in my act. We were very close. He's not very much older than me. He's my mom's younger brother. At the time, he was a DJ, and he was kind of living with us off and on in Houston for a little while because he got on the wrong side of a dope dealer over in Longview, Texas, and they shot him and his little pickup. He had a little Toyota. He called it the Silver Bullet. We're going to talk about it. But they shot that Toyota up, Bubba. They was trying to get him, so he came down to Houston, hid from them for a while. But he was a club DJ at night, and he worked on hot tubs during the day. And he used to slip me mixtapes he had made of Information Society and New Order and music just that I wasn't getting exposed to any other kind of way. Uncle Bobby was a character of the highest order. My mom's little brother. I am going to tell y'all so many stories about this man, but he was an incredible musician, and you know, he ran off to Nashville, did the music thing, kind of screwed his career up with the drugs and stuff. He's one of the most vibrant performers you'll ever see. And he had a funny little quirk. His finger right here didn't bend because his first wife shot him through the door. And I'll just have to tell that whole story one time because that's a whole story. But basically, his first wife shot him, and the bullet went up through his finger and up into his hand. So this finger didn't bend. He was still a hell of a guitar player, but everything he did, like when he was jamming in the car or he was working on something, he always had that finger popped out. And it's funny to me because if y'all are here with me on Sunday, I'm going to be 47 on Monday, right? 47. Monday is my birthday. I turned 47 years old. 47 years old, just because all the time I spent with this man, you will still catch me doing things with that front finger stiff out, especially if I'm adjusting something, a dial or anything like that. Just from his finger being shot off, I picked it up just hanging out with him, you know. For a while, when I was around 14 or 15 years old, him and my mom, when he was staying with us, my mom got a job at the same hot tub place that he worked at. And they would ride together. So what would happen is I would get home from school and I would sneak the keys to the Cutlass Sierra and slip out of the neighborhood and go pick up Melissa. And we would drive around the West Oaks Mall parking lot. I mean, we weren't really doing anything. We didn't have no money, but we could at least drive around the parking lot and look cool and listen to the music, you know. And I had those mixtapes Uncle Bobby would give me. We were jamming. One time, Melissa talked her older brother, Tim, I think. Back then, if music had explicit lyrics, you had to be over 18 to buy it. I don't know if they still do that. But you had to go to a music store to buy music back then. So she talked her older brother and going to Sam Goody with our money and picking us up a Scarface mixtape, I think, and a Ghetto Boys mixtape. And to this day, I don't think Damn It Feels Good to Be a Gangster has ever sounded as good as it did through them rattly asshole AC Delco speakers. We thought we were tough, man. I remember one time my mom and my sister left to go shopping, and I snuck the car out to go cruise with Melissa. And we saw my mom leaving the West Oaks Mall from Mervyn's uncharacteristically early. When my mom went shopping, she's gone for a couple hours, you know. But she must have, I forgot she forgot something or anything, but she turned around. But boy, the driving I did that day to beat Leadfoot Sherry Kay in her Ford Taurus. She had a Ford Taurus that would move like lightning. But when she got back to the house, Melissa and I were sitting on the couch. And, of course, I got yelled at for having a girl in the house alone. But she did let me walk Melissa home that day. And when we got to her house, she kissed me. And I think that was my first kiss, first, like, real kiss with a girl. I just remember I was like on top of the world, floating back to my house, walking back to my house, even though I knew I was grounded when I got there, you know. I got my first truck around that time, which was a, some of you have heard me talk about it. It was a 1972 Ford F-100 with a 360 in it. So I kind of lost interest in the little Cutlass Sierra, but it was like the family spare car. It was always in the driveway. It's rare you even see them little cars anymore. Who knows how many of them are even left, but they do hold a special place in my heart for sure. I got my first speeding ticket in that car too. And I told the cop, I told the cop, I was on the way home from school, and I told the cop that I was speeding on West Park because my air conditioning belt was loose and I had to floor it to keep it from squealing. And I don't remember if the cop laughed, but when I told my dad the story, he asked me if I was the dumbest son of a bitch on the planet. Woo! That little car was tough, though. I'll tell you, it was durable. I jumped there was a railroad tracks at Addicts Clothing or A-Leaf Clothing. Yeah, there's railroad tracks at A-Leaf Clothing. And you hit that railroad tracks enough speed to get that daggum thing off the ground, even with just 90 horsepower, baby. And I hit it so hard one time I bent the skid plate on the bottom of the car. That car just kept on running, kept going. That car. One thing about that car was a success story for General Motors and my family. I don't think I would have been able to figure out some of the mechanical challenges in my life if it hadn't been for the sheer number of hours I spent working on that car with my dad. I can't tell you that the Oldsmobile made me a car guy. I was far more into girls at the time, clearly. But it did teach me that ladies like a capable guy. And my knowledge of automotive repair opened the door to a number of romances along the way as I got older. As always, I'm aware that time is the most valuable gift we could give, and I thank you for yours. I'm very thankful for the feedback and support. And of course, I always look forward to seeing y'all next Sunday. The live chat has become one of my favorite things. I think my goal with this is to do about 25 episodes and then transform it into a live podcast where I can have guests and stuff. But y'all know what to do. If you like it, share it, subscribe it. Please continue to tell your friends about it. And I'll see you next Sunday. I'm JW, and I love you. Damn, it feels good to be a gangster. I mean, one that you don't really.